Welcome to TechLash, a celebration and dissection of the tech industry and its impact on the world. Warning, this podcast has been known to raise awareness, provoke thought, and spark debate. The views expressed by the host do not reflect those of the guests, sponsors, or any other competing interests.
There is a major breakthrough heading to America.
Twitter has iPhone.
Researchers at MIT are hailing a breakthrough in the field of artificial intelligence.
Just how crucial is diversity to the tech world's future?
Facebook will be allowed to settle with
the number of users affected by Yahoo's analytics.
Different economic backgrounds, different educational backgrounds.
Welcome to TechLash. I'm Zibi Nwaka, and I'm here with Theo Miller. Theo, who are we speaking with today?
This week's Zib, we got 8Sleep and the co-founder, VP of Brand and Marketing, Alexandra Zatarain.
Awesome. And what does 8Sleep do?
8Sleep's super cool. It's a mattress company, but there's all sorts of analytics and quantified self elements. They do something really great with branding specifically. That's what I'm really excited about. You know how you've walked into these showrooms? I think we've even been to one of these showrooms together on Van Ness before, where we walk through and all the mattresses look the same and there's no way to differentiate them. They're so commodified. Well, what 8Sleep has done is they've taken the branding of a fitness company like Fitbit, because they have all the tracking, and they've taken all those brand conventions and applied it to what is otherwise an undifferentiated commodity in a mattress, which I think is super awesome.
That is super awesome. I actually did some mattress shopping when I moved into my apartment. It used to be Casper everywhere. I just remember being in the San Francisco SF Muni. It was like Casper advertisements everywhere. And that was the only mattress in a box. When I thought of mattress in a box, I thought of Casper. But now there's Purple and Helix and all these other brands. That's mind-boggling. But 8Sleep's really the first one that I've heard of that is doing this data interactive mattress thing.
And they came up at the same time. They were founded the same year as Casper. So going into the interview with Alexandra, I was like, oh, when I first came across 8Sleep, I figured this was your way of zagging against Casper, adding an extra layer to be competitive with this new wave of mattress companies that are circumventing the showroom. But no, they started the same year, which I think is pretty interesting in and of itself. One other thing I want to highlight is that Alexandra is from Tijuana. She's from Mexico. And then her co-founders, one of which is her husband, they are from Italy. And so that combination, I think, is really interesting when you talk about brand as well. And we get into that in the interview because we cover not only quantified self, but we also talk about diversity. We talk about how that affects the tech company they're building.
That's awesome. Super exciting. Let's jump right into the episode. But first, a word from our sponsor. Diversity has always been an issue in tech, and now it has been compounded with a worldwide pandemic that disproportionately impacts underrepresented groups. This needs to change. FlockJ is a tech sales training academy that helps job seekers from non-traditional backgrounds break into tech. Through 300 plus hours of live instruction, real sales practice, and one-on-one coaching, students master the art and science of tech sales. Top tech companies like Zoom, Gusto, and Airtable partner with FlockJ to hire diverse, elite SDRs that ramp faster and outperform ordinary reps. Visit FlockJ.com to learn more. That's FlockJay.com.
We just happened to be a group of founders who none of us really grew up here. None of us come from the U.S. None of us went to an Ivy League school. We're just the representation of everything that is foreign to our industry, and particularly myself. Being a woman, being Latina, I represent one of the smallest minorities in our industry. And so the perspective that I can bring into how the statement the company should make, the way that we should speak to our employees, is going to be fundamentally different than if I wasn't in that room.
Theo, I'm very honest and forthcoming about the immigration issue and diversity, starting at even the founder level, and the importance to celebrate that and highlight that. I think a lot of our show includes that. And I feel a sense of duty to make this an important focus of my career and all the fortune that I've had with my father and my mother immigrating to the States and giving me a chance for a successful life and career. And many immigrants that I talk to have this sense of responsibility.
And we were preparing for this episode and talking about, well, there is this piece that is just like, it's really hard to build a company. That should be the focus, right? And that's what the investors want you. That's what you probably want to focus on. But then there's also this sense of responsibility for immigrants, for people of color, for underrepresented groups who have gotten to that place, who want to be more inclusive and open the door for other underrepresented groups to come into tech. And so it's this interesting, delicate balance that's there, but I think it's always important. And so it will be a recurring theme for me for the rest of my life as I'm in tech and trying to bring underrepresented groups into tech.
And the novelty of it in this conversation is talking about brand. And growing up in Tijuana, Alexandra had a sense of brand that's very different than you have in the United States. What we talked about a lot in the interview was how in areas where there's greater economic stratification, brand is that much more important because it signals what part of society you're in. It was really obvious when she got on the call. She had these really beautiful Beats headphones that I thought were notable. They stood out. They were like, oh, I get it. This person is sensitive to brand. But then as I talked to her about growing up in Tijuana, she talked about how brand was a way of signaling who you were, what kind of resources you had access to, and it felt fundamentally different than anything we have in the States, especially in more affluent areas where brand is more like, oh, I'll choose from this brand and this brand and this brand. And it says something about my personality generally. But if you're in an environment where there's such great poverty, the role of brand changes. So when we talk about diversity in tech, I do think that the recurring conversation can get a little bit stuck in the mud. But as you unpack it, there's all these layers and dimensions to it that I will find ceaselessly fascinating. On top of that, though, I really want to talk about quantified self and the science of sleep. That's what's super interesting as well.
We know very little about sleep. And what we do know has been studied on very few subjects at a time, subjects that may not represent the entirety of the population. So we need to be very careful about generalizing anything on sleep. There are obviously certain macro things we could all agree on, probably we should all be agreeing on, which is the amount of sleep you get is important. Like, that is for sure. But can I really fundamentally tell you that it's wrong that you do it in a biphasic way or that you should be doing it all in just one shot? I don't know, because maybe that needs to be studied on you and the own effects that it has in your body, which may be different from me.
So I'm not going to front. I didn't know the word biphasic until I came into this interview. I have a sleeping pattern where I actually do kind of like sleeping 3 or 4 hours and then reading. It's more common than people realize. And before electricity was invented, the idea of 8 hours of sleep was a little bit different. We have very modern ideas that you need 8 hours of sleep. And there's studies that you will drive better if you have 8 hours of sleep. It's almost a philosophical thing. Like, I know I feel better with a full 8 hours of sleep, but I don't think that necessarily the goal of life is to feel as good as possible. Sometimes it's to do good in the world. I don't think it's, oh, well, I need to feel completely rested. And you can make the productivity argument, but I actually find the adrenaline of barreling through the day on 4 hours of sleep to be incredibly invigorating.
As I've gotten older, I cherish my sleep. I can't sleep as much. I get, if I'm lucky, like 6.5 hours of sleep. And I've changed to being like, when I get into a deep sleep, I can really sleep. Before, I used to be a light sleeper. It was like, who's there? What noise is that? Like, I could hear footsteps and that would wake me up. And so my sleep has evolved. I also did not know what biphasic meant at all, too. But it's interesting that she's mentioning this because this time and the sequence that we're living in, the 9 to 5, is really a man-made thing, right? So who is to say that the way that we sleep now, it's a result of trying to match to that man-made schedule?
I never worked full time until I turned 30. So my whole pattern was, I'm going to work on this thing the moment I wake up and I'm going to exhaust all my energy. I'm going to take a cat nap in the afternoon and I'm going to keep working harder. So I get two poles of top level energy in the day. That's how I developed as an adult. And then I got into the 9 to 5, to your point, and I was always at odds with it. I was always sleep deprived in the 9 to 5, but now I'm out of that 9 to 5 and I'm in hog heaven. Mm-hmm. So everyone has their own approach to sleep, and I think it is predicated on what their obligations are throughout the day. I don't think it's inherently natural to have a block of 8 hours. I certainly don't think it's dynamic, frankly. I think it's more dynamic to cut that up, because what do you have the moment you wake up? For the most part, you have a level of clarity and focus that you do not have by hour 6 of being awake, let alone hour 12. The people who are working at 9:30 at night, I do not understand these people. I will work for 4 hours. And when I say I work, I mean I block everything out completely and it is laser focus, but I feel that drain my battery. It's almost like when you have a cell phone, you're walking through an area that doesn't have great reception, you go into roaming and your battery starts to drain like hell. That's what it's like when I work, right? Yeah, I am draining the battery and I am going to sleep and I'm going to wake up again. So the idea of a fitness brand for a mattress company resonates with my approach to sleep, right? Because that means I'd be able to monitor exactly how dynamic I can be with my, frankly, more progressive yet more traditional approach to sleep.
Sleep is the ultimate performance enhancing drug. And if you optimize your sleep, you're going to lead a healthier and happier life. That's what we're here for. Our mission is to fuel human potential through optimal sleep. It's not to make you cozier or sleep more comfortably. It's like we're fueling your potential. And you can achieve that with other avenues, right? Like you don't just do it with sleep, but we are here for that sleep portion, which ends up being a third of your life, which is pretty significant. And so if you're the type of person who is looking to achieve your maximum potential, doesn't matter what you do in life, and you understand that sleep is important, you come to Eight Sleep.
I think that's a really hot soundbite, the idea that sleep is the ultimate performance enhancing drug. I do think that Lance Armstrong would push back on that.
I know people who love their sleep. There's multiple people throughout my life who have to get their 8 or 9 hours and they're completely off kilter. And there's a lot of studies that say lack of sleep contributes to more divorce and you're stressed and anxiety and unhappiness. There's a lot of data and statistics around not getting enough sleep. So I do get the analogy of performance enhancing. I don't refute that.
But on the science tip of it, I think it's a lot like doctors who say 2 glasses of wine a day is the secret to a healthy life. There is something to the idea that it lowers your blood pressure, that to relax at the end of the day with 2 glasses of wine is better. But these facts from scientists that lead to more luxurious lifestyles or more indulgent hedonistic lifestyles seem a little convenient to me sometimes. I actually think that it feels great to have a full night's sleep. And I think it feels great to have 2 glasses of wine. And I think that there's science you could pull out that it does create a marginal improvement on your life. But I also think the larger point is there are human reasons to drive toward those conclusions.
I like how Alexandra put in, she's like, we don't really care as much to like make you cozy and comfy, which the reviews have said that this bed is incredibly comfortable, by the way. So I do want to say that, but this is like a data machine that is going to help you tweak and adjust your life, similar to a Fitbit. I got into a Fitbit a year ago and it did really help me in 2020, cutting weight and tracking. Mm-hmm. And I've moved on to an Apple Watch and have been using that. And so I am leaning into the quantified self world. Now there's a debate on both sides of that, and we can get into that in the next few clips.
I will say I've also lost a ton of weight using an Apple Watch, and I think it's a great thing. I will say, though, at this stage where I'm more about maintaining weight than losing weight, it does feel like I have a collar on. And there's days where it's like, oh, I'm not going to wear my collar today. I actually find it incredibly restrictive. And the idea that some people are like, oh, yeah, Apple's building in sleep tracking so I could keep my watch on all night. Nothing would be less appealing to me than having a constrictive device on my wrist while I'm trying to go into deep REM. I don't think that that's the way to do things. And so 8Sleep is a really good solution for that because the whole bed is an Apple Watch.
Our technology is designed to continue to improve every single night. We release updates and features every single month. Your product keeps getting better. You don't have to do anything. So instead of degrading, like you were mentioning, that could happen with a normal mattress, it just keeps getting better. And every year when we launch new technology, there's a bunch of our members that purchased last year that upgrade to the new one this year. It was designed in a way that you don't have to throw up your whole mattress. You just update the technology layer. We thought about all of this because we know that it's a long-term relationship and we want you to be a part of this. You're joining a lifestyle and we hope that we're going to continue to innovate enough that as you grow with us, we will fulfill all of your sleep needs.
Uh-oh. This sounds familiar. Apple completely got me. When I first got into Apple, getting a Mac, I got Apple TV. Now I'm wearing an Apple Watch. I'm completely immersed in these Apple products. And it sounded oddly familiar. It's like, hey, we're constantly getting this data and then we're going to release these new products. I see why investors love 8sleep, but it sounds very, very familiar.
Their branding reminds me of a race car. That's what I think is so cool about it. The figure eight they have looks like a racetrack and it has the block lettering like you would almost have on a Letterman jacket. Everything about it is so exquisitely well done. The reason I'm talking about a race car is it reminds me a lot of Tesla, where Tesla releases those updates, right? They are able to create more value out of the hardware that they ship, in that case, a car, years ago by releasing updates that then improve the performance of the product. So there's an argument that 8sleep is the Tesla of mattresses.
The more invisible that the technology is, there is going to be more widespread adoption of it. If I have to convince my mom, who's in her 60s, to wear a tracker to bed versus just telling her to sleep on this comfortable mattress, which one do we think she's going to take? It's just going to be the mattress. And so that is important for us because data is so fundamental to what we do that we need people to sleep on this bed every night so that we can collect the data and be able to build a true blueprint of who they are as a sleeper. And that is something that we learned by speaking to doctors and professionals who are part of our scientific advisory board who told us that is key. Because unless you can really build a pattern and a trend over long periods of time, the data that you're capturing is not going to be as valuable or actionable.
So I hate wearing my Apple Watch to sleep. I don't like wearing anything on my wrist. And you mentioned that earlier. And this ease of collecting the data where I just live my normal life and these devices start compiling all this data on the quantified self is compelling. And imagine a world where I could just take a picture of something and knows what my diet is and what I'm eating and how I'm sleeping and when I'm exercising and this full quantified self. Now, the opposite side of that is data privacy. And there are a lot of critics who say data fetishism is a really bad thing. One reason is it turns us into these non-human robotic style creatures. And that's one piece. And then the other is the risk of having all this data leaked out. And I've been watching these serial killer documentaries lately, and I've thought about what does the future serial killer look like? In the 70s, you didn't have any of this technology. They would study their victims, right? Their patterns. I think the future, there'll be these very computer savvy hackers that are able to hack into your quantified self, know when you sleep, know what you eat, know what you like. And that's really the future of that whole new age serial killer.
When you're talking about the serial killer thing and you're watching all these true crime docs or series on Netflix, I thought you were going to bring it back to 8sleep and say that you'd love to see how that would impact your sleeping patterns at night. Because I imagine the nights that you're streaming the Ted Bundy doc series, you're not exactly sleeping like a baby. I imagine you're tossing and turning and your blood pressure is all over the map. On the privacy point, it always comes down to how much value can you create? And I think that right now we have a very abstracted privacy debate. People have really vanity-based notions as to how valuable their privacy is. The NSA does not care about your personal conversations. Going back to serial killers, they care about people who are doing bad things. And I think it's a little conspiratorial to get a little too fixated on that. Now, I do think there are bad actors in the tech ecosystem who abuse people's privacy, clearly, as Facebook has established. There's also this pressure from the investment community to create proprietary data sets. And because the industry is geared in that way, the interests of the individual are not prioritized. That's problematic. And Apple has emerged as a brand that says, we'll collect your data if you give us permission. And we're going to tell you what data we're collecting proactively, because they've always been a people-friendly brand, and that makes sense. But Google, they have this longer view that the larger data sets that we collect, the more value we can provide. And that's paramount to everything. So brands have emerged taking different sides of this debate of, is privacy more valuable than convenience? And the jury's still out, but it's a pointless debate. I think over time, the value will increase to the point that privacy itself will be looked at as a trade-off, as it already is, But I think we're in this moment where this data collection is so new that we're having a really naive debate about privacy. There will be a breach that will cause a more serious debate about privacy, but this is like people sitting on the sidelines being like, oh man, it's going to be a crazy game out there. I know how I feel about this, but they're on the sidelines. Cambridge Analytica was disturbing and unacceptable, but what material impact did it have on your life and the lives of people you love?
So I think the privacy debate's more important than you've painted there. Yes, the government doesn't care how you're sleeping and what you're eating until they do. I wasn't concerned about my personal information being hacked during the Equifax. There's been so many. I feel like every few years I get a letter saying, hey, your data was stolen from this thing. Change your passwords. We'll give you a free annual credit check. It doesn't matter until it does. And so you're right. I haven't experienced identity theft, but while I'm banking, I've helped people who did go through it, and it was nightmarish. So I think the privacy thing is actually really important and something that I would almost even lean into or step into first when I'm talking about collecting data on a specific individual.
Privacy, compared to all the other issues that have emerged during the digital revolution, it's not only abstract, but it's just not really that bad relative to the things we don't talk about. So the example that came to mind while you were talking, Zib, was revenge porn and pornography in general. You read about these horrific stories of young women who have photos or videos leaked online and they become suicidal. Some of them kill themselves. Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times writes about this. It's so not talked about and it's so much more immediate of a problem, but it doesn't feed into our narcissism. I don't think people care about it as much. And I think that's unfortunate. So when I say privacy is not as big of a deal as people make it out to be, it's because it's a very self-serving concern. It feeds into our vanity. It seems very American to say, oh, my life is so important. And the idea that everyone is prying into my life is so violating. But if you were to have a more communitarian perspective on it, I think it's a much bigger deal that people are killing themselves because they're getting videos and photos of themselves leaked online.
Yes, you bring up a really good point there. But the value of privacy is being played out right now with Facebook's release. Hey, we're going to start collecting your data on your WhatsApp, which is a monumental mistake. And now Signal servers broke down a day or two ago because they've been trying to buy more servers and keep up with demand. Signal's getting a ton of business. So privacy in this debate seems to be winning. People do highly value their privacy. And that's why I bring it up for these companies that are collecting a tremendous amount of data that I think it's actually a smart business decision to lean first into privacy.
That goes to my point. The fact that privacy is now a brand convention or an approach to brand says everything you need to know about how self-centered our concerns about privacy are.
We are not here to sell you comfortable mattresses. That is very different because it requires different innovation and it requires to prove that your product delivers on a promise of sleep improvement. That is what the mattress companies don't do, and they can't do it because they don't even have the data to prove. They're not tracking you every night. They just sell you the bed and that's it. And they hope that in 8 to 10 years, you can come back and buy from them again. That's their business model and they're great at doing it. It's a completely different view and completely different business. So for us, it's about building a great product that delivers on its promise, that people love so much that they evangelize about it, and that they continue to come back to 8sleep for all of their sleep needs.
Again, when I first came across 8sleep, I figured their branding was positioned in relationship to Casper because Casper jumped on the whole podcasting phenomenon and they carpet bombed all podcasts and they became really well known, at least within a given community. But it's not that. They are really dedicated to the science of sleep at 8sleep. They focus less on comfort, more on performance. And that, I believe, is why their brand is so well articulated through their graphic design and through all of the other choices that we've discussed on this episode.
Yeah, I like that she leads with, hey, we're not selling you the fluffy comfort, you're floating in a cloud. I think this goes back to my point where this is a data company. They want to improve your sleep and use data to do so. They're not going to use just marketing and things are fluffy and cloudy and comfortable. This is a data company, make no mistake.
Yeah, something set in while you were saying that. It does strike me as the perfect product for someone who's going to get up at 6 a.m. and go to CrossFit, right? So it starts out that they're measuring all their CrossFit performance. Then they get into measuring their nutrition. And then this seems to be the third element of that holy trinity, mm-hmm. right? My diet, my exercise, my sleep. And I think that's right. And I think Alexandra's thesis is that it is as relevant as those other two. I agree with that. I think that's where it's headed. I think that taking the idea of sleep and moving it away from comfort and putting it in the column of performance is genius.
I certainly didn't grow up wealthy, but in Mexico, I definitely grew up like middle class. I grew up very close to American culture. So for me, doing the jump, moving to New York after college, it was not that big. I grew up speaking the language. I understood American culture very deeply. And I do think that my experience is very different from someone that, even if they grew up middle class, grew up in a different part of Mexico. And so what I am very conscious about, because of the upbringing that I have and how close I was to seeing inequality, which is very, very evident in a country like Mexico, is that it is really frustrating to see how where you are born and what family you're born into sometimes can really determine the opportunities that you have access to in life.
This goes to the thing you bring up a fair amount, Sib, equal opportunity, not equal outcome.
Yeah, that's exactly what this is. And also, when you go to some other countries and you see the gap of wealth, we talk about the income gap here, and it is expanding in the US, and that is a problem, but it's really, really stark in some of these other countries. It's disheartening. It's tough to see. And you could see by a dirt road with these tiny little tin and wooden shacks and then see a $100,000 Mercedes whizzing by them. And it's these two stark contrasts.
We're headed there, though. That's the whole thing about these tents. If you go down Venice Beach right now, we're not owning up to the economic stratification that's emerging in the United States. And we don't want to admit that the American experiment has failed to the degree that it has.
Yeah, we're on a path that definitely needs to course correct. And we do need a general safety net. I'm a firm believer in capitalism. I think it's the underpinning of a lot of what's made America such a powerhouse. But we do have to have capitalism with some form of a safety net. And as you mentioned and hinted at, the opportunity is really important. So founders coming from this socioeconomic diversity on top of also being diverse founders is really important.
Yeah, the distinction between racial diversity and economic diversity is critical. And I want to reiterate this point about sensitivity to brand growing up in that environment, where to be middle class in Mexico means something different than to be middle class in the United States because of stratification and how that changes your perception of brand. When I was talking to Alexandra about that topic, we talked about New York. I think I was visiting you a couple of years ago, Zib, mm-hmm. and I was on the Lower East Side, and I was at a pizzeria, and I was looking out the window, and one of these punk rockers walked by, and they had a 3-foot, 4-foot tall mohawk with the old school actual glue, you know? Mm-hmm. And that said everything I needed to know, because in San Francisco, there'd be some vague reference to that level of crystallized identity, but it would not be that. It would not be so clearly like, I'm in a big pond and I need to differentiate that I'm this type of fish. I'm not that type of fish. Mm-hmm. And on the West Coast in San Francisco, it's a pretty small pond and everyone's a little bit similar. So someone's not going to be full on punk. They're going to be like punk light. And then you go into smaller and smaller cities and it gets lighter and lighter and lighter. My point is that the more diversity that there is, the more important brand becomes. But you compound that level of diversity with economic stratification and the role of brand becomes that much more important. And that's why it's so fascinating to look at 8Sleep, because I see the crystallization of their brand vision as a reflection of Alexandra's upbringing in Mexico, which is a testament to the importance of diversity in tech.
The socioeconomic diversity is so important. And to me, that one of the where they come from encompasses like, where did you go to school? How do you speak the language? Do you have an accent? Are we tolerant to people who do have an accent and don't speak it perfectly and don't have perfect grammar? There are all of these little subtle things that end up making people either feel left out or completely left out. And so it comes down to kind of the smaller interactions and the smaller implied rules of how we behave with one another that end up leaving people out of the ecosystem. The access to opportunities thing and how do we bring them to people who are really far removed from them at the moment, I believe is still the biggest challenge.
some of the trends that are happening, moving to a remote and distributed world, this is actually going to help that tremendously. Pulling away from having to be in the Bay Area and be one person in a house of five coders because housing's super expensive. Now it's this world where you can be in Poland, you can be in Lagos, Nigeria, you can be in Sao Paulo, you can be in another country and contribute and be diverse and be part of this team, regardless of your socioeconomic background. So this move to distributed work and remote work in the internet, I think, is going to have a significant impact on increasing socioeconomic diversity in tech. And I think that's one way that companies like 8Sleep and other companies that employ remote workers can bring more access and opportunity to certain folks from not as privileged backgrounds.
The bigger the pool, the more innovation you're going to have. And I want the top 1% of the world. I don't want the top 1% of one gender, of one race, in one country. So the interconnectivity of the internet is helping with this, but I also think the consciousness is lagging. And that's what this show is about. We want to make sure that the consciousness keeps pace with technology.
If you are diverse at the top, all of your practices from there are going to be much more diverse than if you aren't. The moment that you have the first person in your company that is going to go through maternity or paternity leave, you need different voices in the room that decide what are the protocols going to be like and what is the company going to offer to support them in that journey. The moment that you have any sort of issues with diverse hires or people who feel like there would be harassment, as a company, you're going to hopefully avoid as many of those, but you could also experience tons of them. And I think the companies that are going to be better armed to protect their employees and their business are going to be the ones that have more diversity at a leadership level and at a board level too.
So this goes back to why the investment community needs to be more diverse, because if you're going to have more diverse founders, you're going to need to have investors that are interested in pursuing those investments. And unconscious bias works its way into every layer of the stack.
This is network effects happening for diversity. And we're seeing NASDAQ requiring having a woman on the board in order to list on NASDAQ. So These organizations and entities and businesses are starting to take notice and put some work and requirement. It will take time. And I think it is important to have the diversity at the top. They don't have to think of it as an afterthought. It's just ingrained in them.
It would change your experience being a young person at the company if you resemble the person who leads the company. You're going to think of your role in that community differently. You're going to think of your role in that community as predetermined as opposed to a privilege.
Language should be inclusive, but I don't think that that's necessarily going to solve the fundamental issues of the world. What is going to be the difference between Latinx or Latino and Latina? I don't see us gaining any benefit as a community from banning a word at the moment. I think there are deeper issues and things that we should be thinking about that are going to drive our presence in this country forward, our equality in this country forward. So why don't we focus on those discussions? And why don't we take action in those discussions? We need to start having a little bit more vision of what are we really going to get out of this if we spend our time for the next 2, 3, 6 months fighting this fight. And is it worth it? Because if not, there's 100 other fights that we could pick on that are probably going to yield better results.
Alexandra's really singing our song here. We talk about this a lot. The importance of words being overstated at this moment. With the democratization of communication through Twitter, it's really tempting to police what people say and downplay the much larger importance of action. In the 1960s, there was Malcolm X and there was Martin Luther King Jr., and they had a profound effect on society. But what people don't talk about is they don't talk about Whitney Young Jr., who brokered deals in corporate America, who went into the boardrooms and broke down systemic racism through action that is harder to communicate. And so oftentimes when I think about this distinction between words and action, when you break it down to this dichotomy, you often see that when people overstate the importance of language, I feel like they want to pass on doing the harder work of it. It's the Slacktivist era. It's the Twitter era of people being like, well, you know, I can put out the 240 characters and I can say that word is bad, but I'm not going to get off my couch and actually make a difference in the world.
Yeah, I agree. It's the easy way out to focus on language. I've been fascinated by this Latinx movement because any of the Latin folks in my life who have that background, they never really heard of it in the language. It's brand new to them. And I read a few op-eds, one by Hector Luis Alamo, a writer at the publication in Latin Rebels, and Daniel Hernandez in an LA Times op-ed. And they made an interesting case for this. And I'm always fascinated by other people creating a word that they need to absolve themselves of guilt, I suppose. And the point that both of these authors made was it's inherently an exclusive word. So although its aim is to create inclusivity, Latinx is actually an exclusive word created by academic elites. So it was birthed out of Latin at symbol. So they were trying to combine the A and the O. So all the best intentions to remove gender out of the word, and then it evolved into Latinx. But this came out of these elite academic circles. And so these two authors, who are both Latino, they are essentially saying that this word is actually exclusive in its birth. It's not an inclusive word.
It also sounds dehumanizing, because when you think about it, where else have we heard X? We hear iPhone X. And so what's essentially happening is the white liberal sect that is trying to protect this group of people with a white savior mentality is equating them to a phone, an object. They're objectifying a group of people, which is, to your point, the opposite direction we need to go in.
Another thing brought up by Hector Luis Alamo was he's also saying on this tangent of it being an exclusive word, it's also like, we don't need this academic elites to tell us how gendered our languages. We're already well aware this is the underpinning of the whole language. Oh, and by the way, not just Spanish, anything from Hindi to German, as Daniel Hernandez points out, many languages are gendered. So you would have to actually change the full definition. Oh, and by the way, X has many different pronunciations in Spanish. For example, you take the town of Oaxaca, there's an X in there. It's almost pronounced with an H. So it's taking this Americanized version of the word that's not even usable in their own language. So it's almost like pushing this language onto a group of people.
I agree with you that you would have to change the language itself, but that's the idea of dismantling systemic bias and systemic discrimination.
That's our show for today. If you enjoyed it, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. That would really help us out. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at mailbag@hitstartmedia.com. For Theo Miller, I'm Zibby Nwaka. Have a great week.